You know, when you're doing the mandala, offering a short mandala, how do you visualize the universe? You're offering the universe, right? Yes, that's something I've been wondering lately, see? Whether you go for the modern scientific kind of presentation of the universe or more traditional view. What about you, Jane? Have you got traditional leanings? Yeah. And rabbits with horns. Tables when nobody's looking at them. Yeah.
Do they still teach Mount Marion?
Well, if you do the lung mandala, it's mentioned, isn't it? Yeah. You know, it's definitely explicitly written there. But yes, ages ago, Dalai Lama sort of started putting out the word, you shouldn't really, you know, take that seriously. And it's just sort of mythical at best. But there isn't really a big mountain at the centre of the universe. And that's been sort of disproved by science or something. So he was quite clear about that at one point. I don't say anything much about it now. But I was just wondering how I visualized it. And sometimes I use the old visualization, sometimes a more modern sort of scientific one. So I just wondered how you sort of did it. Yes. Yeah, all the objects of your attachment, all the objects of your anger and so forth, visualizing those and offering them to the Buddha. And asking to be, you know, to see your afflicted minds as empty. Yes, that's great. But actually, you know, visualizing the universe. Because, you know, Mount Meru is it's a mountain with four sides, isn't it? One side is blue. Our world is blue and our sky is blue because we are facing the blue side of Mount Meru. But the other sides are white, I don't know, red, green maybe. So the different worlds, which may also contain humans, but they're, you know, and different sort of islands facing this mountain. And all the desire realm gods and then the form realm gods are above those. Pure lands or somewhere high on the mountain. Do you visualize it like that, Mike? Yeah. Well, if you do it in real detail like that, you've got all these specific kind of, you know, wonderful objects that you find in the different lands. You've got to be quite careful, yeah. So you'll probably be a very good tantric meditator then, with all this, getting all the 238 Kalachakra deities in place, sitting in the right chairs and everything. Yeah, I mean, we visualize these sort of imaginary worlds in Tantra, those of us who practice that, so it's not kind of, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, sort of visualize the Pure Land and everything. So yeah, I tend to do a mixture of like the old visualization and the modern visualization, but I wonder what anybody else did.
Personally, where there's a modern visualization, modern interpretation or something, I tend to use that rather than mythology. I tend to mentally sort of separate the two as mythology and culture and Western scientific methods, but it's something I'm familiar with.
Yeah. But when there's only the traditional one, you use the traditional one. Or if you're meditating on a deity's mandala, you bring in all modern comforts, do you? Like in the palace. Yeah, exactly. Penthouse overlooking the Mediterranean. Yeah, so it's got plenty of possibilities to think about. But when we taught it, you know, this, it comes an Abhidharma, like the treasury of knowledge by Vaspandu. So we were taught by a teacher who had, you know, done most of his education in Tibet, but obviously very faithful to Dalai Lama, very listened to everything Dalai Lama said. So there's one chapter, the third chapter, I think it is, where it gives all these dimensions of and all the details of the traditional world picture. So, you know, it tells you how thick the walls are on in the desire god realm, you know, around the palaces, and then you go to the next realm and the walls are even longer and they're made of crystal, and, you know, they're 70 feet high instead of 60 feet high, and it gives loads of incredible detail. How many sort of miles below the center, below the surface of the earth the hell realms are, and everything, you know, it gives it all in, you know, sort of very sort of fixed picture. But he says, oh, well, we better not teach that then. So we just left the whole chapter out. Of course, the Dalai Lama has started saying, you know, that Mount Meru has just been disproved by science or whatever. So we just left it out. And that was all we could do. Yes, so modern adaptations. Anyway, that's just a question I had. Yeah.
And it didn't really have any connection to, you know, the traditional
symbology of the Madhava. Yeah, but you are supposed to visualize the whole of creation, aren't you? The whole of the universe. It's a very inclusive meditation, isn't it? But visualize them in a very, as if everything is pure, isn't it? So not like it actually is. But everything is just marvelously wonderful, offerable. Yeah. Okay, well, that's good. Wow. Many possibilities. So the next lot of points then are all from the exalted knower of all aspects. But we won't get too bogged down in this. We'll have a reading of the sutras in a minute for lunch, shall we? So we'll do some a resounding of the first chapter of the Perfection of Wisdom in 18,000 verses. But we'll just look at some of these points and then give us something to meditate on after lunch as well. So I'm on page 61. Aspect of an exalted knower of all aspects, otherwise known as the omniscient mind. Same word in Tibetan. I think in sort of kind of ordinary people who've been brought up Christian tradition, they've heard of omnipotent, so omniscient kind of probably makes sense to them. But when you are talking in the Onum of clear realization kind of, you know, context, it makes sense to say the knower of all aspects. Nam Ken. So it's like they're always talking about all these so many different aspects. But it's just the same word in Tibetan for the omniscient mind. 110 aspects of the exalted knower of all aspects. Okay. So now we think we're getting somewhere. But immediately we have this sort of complication where if you divide the 110 aspects of an exalted knower of all aspects, then what do you find? You get 37 aspects of an exalted knower of all aspects concordant with those existing in hearers, 34 aspects of the exalted knower of all aspects concordant with those existing in bodhisattvas, and 39 uncommon, you know, unique aspects of an exalted knower of all aspects. So we thought, oh, well, we've finished with the knower of bases, we've finished with the knower of paths, so now we're just on to, you know, Buddha's exalted mind itself, and what's that got there? But then immediately it's going back to, oh well, aspects of the exalted knower concordant with those existing here is whatever that means. And aspects of an exalted knower of aspects concordant with those existing bodhisattvas. So you're going back to where you've just come from somehow. I mean, the different aspects, but it's a bit, you can see it's a bit confusing for somebody who's just not been there before, not looked at these before. Okay, now, the first lot, the 37 aspects, the 37 aspects of an exalted Lord of all aspects concordant with those in hearers. So we're just there at the moment, yeah? So, somewhere, I've got a page reference. Oh, here it is. So in this commentary, which is a commentary from the Kagyu point of view, actually, this particular one, but it's not a sort of specialist answer at all, but just somebody's asking about that. You know, you just talked about the aspects of Narabasis and the aspects of Narapaths, so why, when you get to the aspects of the exalted Lord of all aspects, that you're going back to talk about something concordant, aspects concordant with those existing in hearers, and aspects concordant with those existing in bodhisattvas all over again. So you may wonder, but isn't this a repetition of the above explanations on the aspects of the knowledge of basis and the path? There is no flaw, since the above explanations were given in terms of the limited scope of these aspects in the bodhisattva's own mind streams, whereas here, these aspects are presented by way of a Buddha's mind possessing them, with their nature being all-encompassing. So there is an explanation, but it's not particularly sort of enriching, is it? Anyway, I'm not trying to criticise, but just got to get our minds around what's happening, what's there. But the first lot then, the 37 aspects of an exalted knower of all aspects, concordant with those existing in hearers. Okay, well, let's read the verses. Let's see how it actually looks. So there's two verses here, 4.4, 4.5, fourth and fifth verse of the fourth chapter. So what we're talking about here isn't expanded at length in great detailed verses. They're just giving the numbers, actually. So I'll read the verses. Those ranging from close placements of mindfulness until the final aspect of Buddha are divided into three types of exalted knowers of all, in accordance with true paths. Therefore, for learners, bodhisattvas, and Buddhas respectively, 37, 34, and 39 are asserted. So the order of clear realizations is just rounding them all up into, you know, three bunches. When you look at the sutra, you'll find, you know, there'll be 37 phrases or 34 phrases, that is the 39 sentences, giving each of these ones probably in quite cryptic kind of words, so it's really hard to pick out what they actually mean, but somebody's done it for us. So there are then 110 knowers of an exalted knower of all aspects. 110 knower aspects of an exalted knower of all aspects. These exist only in the continuum of a Buddha Arya. Yeah, so the actual ones are only in the Buddha's continuum. So the completely fulfilled ones or something, the completely awakened ones, or the completely perfected ones, let's say, the perfection of wisdom. However, similitudes of most of these aspects do exist in the continua of Hinayana and Bodhisattva Aryas. So like the first lot of them, the first topic is the close placements of mindfulness, you know, so that's something that, you know, is a well-known practice. So of course, you know, Hinayana and Bodhisattva superior should have some, you know, kind of a skill in those, but they're only the similitudes. They aren't the perfect ones. The perfect ones are the proper ones are only in the Buddha's continuum. But in Hinayana and Bodhisattva superiors, you will find a similitude of them. But everybody, you know, who's, you know, there's so many people do these practices. So we are practicing like a similitude of a similitude, I suppose. When the aspects are divided, well, when the aspects are divided, there are three types by means of three different supports of presentation. Three different supports means three different beings in whom the practice takes place. You know, the three beings, three different types of beings who practice, learn here as bodhisattvas and buddhas. Okay, let's continue. So, 37, 34, 39. 37 aspects of an exalted knower of all aspects concordant with those existing in hearers. That's where we are, the first of the three bunches. And underneath the first box it says, these 37 knower aspects are also known as the 37 harmonies with enlightenment. They're divided into seven groups, each of which is attained at a different stage on the path to enlightenment, as shown in chart number 1.2. So you may have heard of the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. Where have you heard of them? Yeah. In what context, do you remember? Well, yeah, one thing to point out, there is a text called the 37 Practices of Enlightenment, 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva by Tobin Sangpo, is it? So that's, don't get these confused with those. So those are, you know, the unusual number of 37, you think, oh, that's another thing I got confused about, you know, are they talking about the same thing? But I don't think they are, they're just 37, you know, practices of this Bodhisattva Tommy Zampo has, you know, put into a poem for, you know, as his sort of a kind of, you know, expression of his sort of bodhisattva aspirations and so forth. So they're not these 37. But these 37 are quite well known, I think. Where have you heard of them from before then? You know, I think, you know, if you're going into the Theravada tradition, you'll find these 37 are talked about. Am I wrong? I don't know. I don't know much about the Theravada tradition. I'm you know, my vague contact with that tradition leads me to think that these groupings are found there. You know, they're sort of groupings from the Abhidharma, from, you know, the non-Mahayana, pre-Mahayana, whatever. They're sort of, you know, they're sort of hero practice type lineages or whatever, Abhidharma kind of teachings, so they'll be found there. So they are not just sort of something dreamed up in the Mahayana context. So there'll be people with familiarity with these. You know, the four close placements of mindfulness, the first lot amongst the 37, very familiar. You know, that's probably the main practice of somebody in some of these Theravada traditions. Am I right? Doesn't sound like anybody's had much familiarity themselves either. And if yeah, but the eightfold path. Look, the last of the groups within the 37 harmonies of enlightenment. They're always talking about the eightfold path, aren't they? The eightfold. A modern thing. Oh yeah. 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 Well, they're definitely the Arya level in our
too. Yeah. I mean, maybe if John was here, he'd have more idea of these things, would he? He's talking about his mindfulness meditations, Vipassana meditations in what tradition does he say? Thai tradition or? But there was an advert for his course out there right now, isn't there?
Yes, he does meditation, and he's lying on the website, otherwise he gets teaching actually to tell him what to do. Because he was fed up with everyone listening and having the cycle of the class, so it would be a good sign.
Yeah, well, Vipassana, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So there's no doubt that these, at least the first four, are kind of very widely practiced. But I was, I thought if John and people were here, I'd get some feedback on how other people tackle them. But he's off in Strasbourg or somewhere. So, my meagre knowledge of them, I wouldn't be embarrassed by that particularly, because nobody else seems to have an expert knowledge of them in the audience. So. You know, it's not something that we practice like as in our monasteries, and I doubt if you, even if you're in a much more meditative kind of tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, like, the Kagyus or something, I'm not sure how these would be really like a, these are what you focus on, chaps, get on with it, They still wouldn't be like the sort of the central way of practicing things, or at least not given the name, the four close placements of mindfulness, although in the end, what you're trying to get at is very much, you still have the goal, you're still aiming at the goal, which the four close placements of mindfulness are supposed to lead you to. Anyway, maybe we could just look at the handout sheet first now, just to introduce them. So you've got this sheet there, there's a couple of paragraphs on the four close placements, just to get us going. So page 2, 2e, 110 aspects of the exalted knower of all aspects, 37 aspects concordant with those existing in hearers, first four close placements of mindfulness, and you have the traditional four, close placement of mindfulness on bodies, feelings, minds, and phenomena. So this quotation is from Gen Lanrimpa Ngawang Punso, but you'll find quotations from, saying exactly the same thing in books which aren't from the Mahayana tradition, such as the Heart of Buddhist Meditation, Nyanaponika Thera, from Sri Lanka and so forth, very much focusing on these subjects. So, what keeps us in samsara? So, Genlan Rinpa, Ngawan Punso, he said, four false graspings at the pure, the pleasurable, the permanent, and at the self are responsible for the suffering of embodied beings wandering in samsara. By mistaking the impermanent to be permanent, the impure to be pure, what is suffering to be happiness, and what is selfless to be a self, we in this way become attached and cling to outer and inner phenomena and accumulate various evil actions, as the effect of which we have to experience these varieties of fierce suffering for a long time. They do not arise without a cause, nor from inappropriate causes. So, if we want definitely to be free from suffering, we must abandon the four fallacies. So it's saying ignorance is keeping us in cyclic existence. If you want to say, well, what is the ignorance? Then it's the ignorance grasping at itself above all. That's kind of the root ignorance. But then when you sort of branch it out a bit, give us a bit more, add a bit more sort of flesh to the bones, then they give four wrong consciousnesses, four wrong views, four wrong graspings. So we're grasping at, maybe you should start off with the pure one then, so the impure to be pure, so that's false views of our own bodies, I think, views of our own and others' bodies, appearing to be, pure or wonderful, when it doesn't take much analysis to discover they are very kind of dodgy in their sort of nature. And then the pleasurable, what is
actually suffering in samsara, but we are constantly grasping it as being happiness. It's the only happiness we know, so we can't really be blamed for it if we are kind of just ordinary wandering samsaric beings, you know, compared to the suffering experience is something that looks pleasurable. But as I said, compared to the perspective of somebody who's realized emptiness, somebody who's got an idea of their own Buddha nature, somebody who's really, you know, awakened to their possibilities of becoming a transcendent Buddha, then just sort of being sort of bewildered by the events of samsara and taking them to be pleasurable, you know, greatly mistaken. Dumbing ourselves down. And then another one is taking the impermanent to be permanent. So this is another crucial error. You know, the fault of samsara, one of the faults, or how we decide things in samsara, our sort of suffering, is because, you know, they're all impermanent. So they're all kind of, you know, slipping out of our hands. And, you know, not just gross impermanence, but subtle impermanence needs to be meditated on. So that is, you know, kind of another great fault in our way of looking at things. And the last one is, yes, grasping at a self. Things don't have any self in any sort of kind of the way of being no control of self, grasping at things. No control of self, telling the aggregates what to do. This is self-sufficient, substantially existent self. And then from the mind-only point of view, yeah, there's no self of phenomena in the sense of phenomena having their own kind of sort of a substantial existence apart from the mind apprehending them. And then from the middle way point of view, nothing has any true existence, nothing has any way of being, you know, from its own side without, you know, being sort of posited there by a correct mind. So those different types of selflessness being sort of completely obscured by our sort of pitiful, ignorant minds, then we are involved again and again in samsara, again and again in suffering. So we have to counter those wrong views. And, you know, the four close placements of mindfulness are antidotes for those four errors. So we've got to get rid of those four errors somehow. We've got to sort of see find the correct way of looking at things. And these four close placements of mindfulness are kind of four antidotes, four way of looking at things correctly. So regarding this, the Lord formulated the four close placements of mindfulness as antidotes for the four errors. The four close placements of mindfulness on the body, one by one now, the close placement of mindfulness on the body was formulated as the antidote for the error that regards the impure as pure. The close placement of mindfulness on the feelings was formulated as the antidote for the error that regards what is unsatisfactory as a state of well-being. The close placement of mindfulness on the mind was formulated as the antidote for the error that regards what is impermanent as permanent. The close placement of mindfulness on phenomena was formulated as the antidote for the error that regards what is not a self as constituting a self. Okay, so that's the Sangha. So it's a Mahayana approach, but you'll find again, you know, in the texts of non-Mahayana Buddhists, you'll find the same kind of alignment being made. I have to say, I mean, even though that's a Sangha, wouldn't dare to be critical of a great being like a Sangha. You know, he's some towering figure in Tibetan Buddhism, isn't he? You know, so associated with the mind-only view and, you know, sort of Buddhism as he saw it, you know, as he explained it, has gone, you know, very far from India, all over sort of the other parts of Asia. So he's a sort of a greatly revered figure, not just in Tibet. And the challenge, it seems to me, you've got to realize, okay, you know, impure nature of your own body, cut down sort of unnecessary desire, attachment, impure nature of the human body in general. You've got to realize impermanence. So then, once you realize impermanence, then you've got a great sort of, you know, advance on your understanding of samsara as being suffering. So then you've got a real kind of basis for your sort of turning away your revulsion from samsara, your renunciation, which is basically what this is about. And then once your renunciation is very strong, once your sort of, you know, being impatient, being fed up, or being despairing with samsara is strong enough, then you really have a sort of, you know, push, a really kind of great sort of impulse from within to understand what selflessness is all about. And anything you need to understand selflessness, like, you know, developing calm abiding, developing sort of the insights, the logical reasons to prove all that, you know, you'll be working at them kind of with enthusiasm because of your sense of renunciation. So this is obviously a common practice. It's not something that is exclusive to Mahayana, but, you know, this idea of getting that renunciation in place is obviously, you know, just a common practice for all the different vehicles. So those are what you've got to realize, those four. So the idea of you've got to realize one, the impurity one, is on the body. Well, that's fair enough, because that's where that meditation is basically, you know, that's basically what it's focusing on, attachment to the body. You know, you can say, well, all earthly environments are also impure, so you shouldn't get attached to the wonderful things in the external world. So they all have their kind of, you know, shortcomings too. Yes, you know, just because you've got a, you know, whatever it is, you treasure material possessions. But I think the idea of pure and impure really does relate to the body, I think, mainly, bodies. But then, okay, so then you want to realize what worldly people often take to be happiness, you realize even that is suffering, yeah? Plenty of suffering in the world, but what worldly people take as to be happy, you've got to also see that as suffering, you know, and the objects of sort of worldly people's neutral minds, you've got to see that as suffering. So it's kind of saying that then is in order to do that, you meditate on feelings. Yeah, so each one's got to be like a different subject of meditation. So you've got the body, impure. Feelings lead you an understanding of suffering. Well, maybe. And then when you put the close placement of your mindfulness on the mind itself, that's the third of the four kind of topics, then that's the point at which, or that's your opportunity, that's where you'll develop the antidote for regarding what is impermanent as permanent. So that's especially associated with the mind for some reason. You know, I'm not quite, you know, it's not quite convinced about that. Why should it be specifically the mind that you have to think about when you want to understand impermanence? Okay, the mind is very impermanent, you know, it's very easy to see the mind's changing all the time. I don't know if that's why what they mean. Anyway, the last one, the close placement of mindfulness and phenomena. So phenomena here means anything that is not covered by the other 3 points, I think. You know, so it can be all the other functioning things, all the permanent phenomena, the ones that are just the more abstract phenomena, and all the other mental factors, the sort of associated mental factors like virtues and non-virtues and so forth. Mind being, you know, the main mind, and then the mental factors, I think, are included under phenomena here. So that's a very various collection of inner and outer items. So when you meditate on that, that's where you'll meditate phenomena, that's where you develop your realization of selflessness. I'm not really convinced by that. You know, I think you want to realize, okay, impure, impermanent, suffering, selfless. Yeah, so I think whatever item, whatever object to observe you choose, it's up to you, really. But maybe these people doing the close placement of mindfulness meditation very professionally, they'll they'll show you it's different, so I can't say. But most of the meditations that people are familiar with are just meditations on the body. So you meditate on the breathing, that's a very familiar one for mindfulness, so that's counted as the meditation, mindfulness of close placement of mindfulness on the body. And then the meditations on the impurities of the body and the sort of different items of the body listed, and going through all the different items of the body, recognizing different parts of your body, scanning the body. So all those meditations which we at least have we've heard of and maybe practice. So those are all included in mindfulness regarding the body. So it does seem to say sometimes that those are the ones you really practice, and your observation of your feelings will come in relation to your meditation on the body. So, okay, your main object is a breath, but then feelings come up, yeah? Feelings come up, you feel tired, or you feel hot, or your back is aching, and so forth, whatever feelings from the past, memories, and so forth. So plenty of feelings will come up of happiness and suffering from your different sort of experiences. So the feelings come into the meditation on the body as the main object. Same with the other observations about mind and phenomena. So you don't necessarily meditate on all those different ones at a different time, separately, but the other ones will keep coming in. You keep observing what's going on in your feelings, you keep observing what's going on in your mind, while your main object of meditation remains the breath or going through the different parts of the body and so forth. That's what he suggests, anyway, this Nyanaponika Tera. So he says, therefore, it is necessary that the disciple of this method should cultivate all four contemplations or objects of mindfulness mentioned in this discourse whenever they come into the range of his daily experience. The systematic meditative practice, however, centers, as will be shown later, on a very few selected subjects taken from contemplation of the body. But the other objects of mindfulness will likewise have ample opportunity to come into the range of observation and should then receive full attention. So it doesn't have to be meditation just when you're sitting, on your cushion, meditating in that way. It doesn't have to be like that. It can be, you're mindful of these things all the time when you're sitting, standing, walking, sleeping, lying down, let's say. So it doesn't have to be like formal meditation. But when it is formal meditation, it seems to suggest, that you select the selected subjects that you concentrate on are from contemplation of the body, and then the other ones will have a chance to come in then. And so you'll be forced to think about your feelings and observe what's going on, so on, and observe where they're coming from. They're coming from your craving or whatever, so you'll get your sort of insight going. So we'll try meditating on the body a bit after lunch. Yeah, so that's the briefest introduction. So how do you actually meditate? Do you have a conception of how you meditate on these in accordance with this instruction, the four close placements of mindfulness? Do you have your own idea of how that should be done? Do you have your own, previous practice of these things? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I could say what I think, just from my own experience, which isn't very much, because I've never considered that I'm doing the four close placements of mindfulness myself. And I've been meditating because it's not really been given a great deal of attention in our training, except it comes up at places like this. when we're trying to be inclusive of everything. But I don't know, maybe you want to discuss that as a discussion point? Is that too nebulous for you? Yeah, you've got the four false graspings that Nawang Punsok has put down for you. So how are you going to penetrate through to those realizations? How are you actually going to meditate? Is that too vague for you? Too indigestible? Or you want to discuss that? Because you've got to...
Yeah, he's saying, you know, you're stuck in cyclic existence because you're thinking of the impure as pure, which definitely relates to the body, I think. And then, you know, you take what is suffering to be pleasurable, you take what is... you keep thinking of what is impermanent to be permanent, you're grasping at that, and you keep grasping at what doesn't have a self, to have a self. So then you are stuck in your sort of repetitive cycle of rebirth. So how do you meditate on them, on those things? Is that something you can discuss? Okay, we'll leave it like that. Somebody have nodded, so that's enough. We can't, you know. I think there are things to compress, contrast, you see, but if I just say what I think, it just sits there and listens. No. Anyway, this is the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. We've got half an hour before lunch, so we can have a read-through now. So we'll come back to the close place of the mindfulness after lunch then. So this is just the first chapter, so we won't find any reference to our own, you know, fourth chapter here. But what can you do? This is a translation I've got. We could photocopy. So we won't get through too much, because there's only a few of us. How many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So these are in 10 sheep bunches. So if you finish 10 before, you know, lunchtime, you can easily do another 10. If you want to take it slowly, take it slowly. But if you were here before, you know how we do it, right? We read through, read it out loud, you know, just go through it steadily. And first of all, before we start reading, we should just think about the four methods of purification. So we take refuge, which we've already done, we can say. And then we regret our negative actions. Yeah. So then we have an opponent power of virtuous action. Reading the sutra is a very classic one, as kind of, you know, purification or pacification of our fierce negativities. And then, you know, once we've finished the reading, once we've stopped for lunch, then we can, you know, we resolve not to do those negative actions ever again, as much as possible. Okay, so just exposure to Perfection of Wisdom itself in all its immediacy. So try to think about your negative actions, regretting. Perfection of Wisdom is here, the blessings to purify, to calm, to pacify our minds, to straighten out our energies, to turn our minds away from, you know, the sort of devious addictions and become pure and open up to that
Buddha energy, that sort of timeless nature that the mind has, of, you know, the timeless potential of being completely enlightened, completely, you know, effortlessly loving. So this is our kind of, you know, our evolutionary possibility. You know? Even when we die and go into that state of, you know, the clear light of passing away from this life, there must be a moment, surely, when you have a sense of that kind of, you know, completeness, which is just quite hidden from us when we're just going about our busy daily lives. So, you know, it's just waiting for us. It's just waiting for us to arouse ourselves. So let's purify our minds so we can get to that state very quickly. So let's all start reading now. Read out loud as you can. Just don't get your pages mixed up. As soon as you finish 10, you can have another 10. If you're a quick reader, but if you're a slow reader, that's fine. Just go slowly, no problem. An apparition and the intrinsic nature of the Tathagata's magical creation is empty of the intrinsic nature of the Tathagata's magical creation. to our final bit of resolving not to commit those negative actions again while we visualize the power of the Facts and Wisdom Sutras, the Facts and Wisdom itself, purifying, calming our mind that is stained with the stains of negativity. So dedicate the merits to the perfection of wisdom dawning in our minds, or being revealed in our minds, realizing its potential there. For the benefit of all beings. Then we'll make the food offering prayer. Om Ahum, Om Ahum, Om Ahum. To the precious Buddha Peerless Guide, to the precious Dharma Peerless Refuge, to the precious Sangha Peerless Liberators, we offer the three jewels of refuge. This food with 100 flavors, attractive and well prepared, is offered to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas with devotion. May all beings enjoy the wealth of the food of concentration. Seeing this food as medicine, we eat it without attachment or hatred. Not out of avarice or pride or a wish for an enviable body, only to sustain the body.